I mean, imagine just walking up to a highly respected religious scholar and saying, you know, I fundamentally disagree with you about what happens when we die.
Right. A pretty massive topic.
Exactly. You tell them, like, I don't think there's an afterlife at all. No immortal soul, no resurrection, nothing. When we're dead, we're just dead.
And in our modern world, that's a relationship ender.
Oh, totally. But in this scenario, the scholar just nods, pats you on the back, and says, cool, we're still brothers in the faith.
Yeah, it was a completely acceptable, polite difference of opinion in the ancient world.
Which is wild. But then, say you take a bucket of water to wash your hands before a ritual, right? And maybe a few drops splash in the wrong direction.
Oh, boy.
Suddenly, that exact same scholar is screaming at you, excommunicating you, and treating you like a literal agent of corruption.
Yeah, it's... To our modern minds, it is the absolute definition of having your priorities completely upside down.
It really is. And welcome, everyone, to this deep dive into Dr. Anthony Tomasino's lecture on the Jewish sex.
So glad to be here for this one.
Yeah, today we are decoding the ancient psychology of in-groups. You know, how human beings process information to form incredibly distinct factions.
And really, why the loudest, angriest voices in any society usually represent a surprisingly tiny minority.
Right. So by the time we wrap up this deep dive, you, the listener, are going to understand the underlying mechanics of why ancient thinkers could just calmly debate the cosmic reality of the resurrection, but literally lose their minds over the physics of a hand-washing bucket.
The infamous bucket.
Exactly. Okay, so let's unpack this. Because before we can look at how a society splinters into these furious little factions, we have to establish the baseline, right?
Yeah, but you have to know what unites them first.
Right, like what actually united the Jewish people in the centuries right before the time of Jesus.
Well, because you can't have a sect unless there is a main body to break away from.
Exactly.
So during this highly Hellenized period, surrounded by Greek and Roman culture, there were four absolute non-negotiables. Like, if you wanted to be considered part of the community, you had to adhere to these four pillars.
Okay, lay them out for us.
First, monotheism. Just one God. Second, circumcision. Third, the Torah, you know, the laws of Moses. And fourth, the temple in Jerusalem as the ultimate legitimate place for sacrifice.
Okay. Now, if you're listening, you likely know what those four things are. But what's really fascinating here isn't just the list itself, but how they functioned over time as a mechanism of exclusion.
Right, the filtering process.
Yeah. Think of the religion like a giant, incredibly wide beam of light. Over the centuries, history keeps putting up these massive wooden boards in front of the light, and each board has a slightly smaller hole cut into it.
I love that visual. It's perfect for the historical reality.
Right. Because like Moses puts up the first board, he says, no idols, follow these core laws. And the beam of light gets tighter.
Right. And then centuries later, King Josiah puts up another board.
Right.
He basically outlaws worshiping on random local hilltops and mandates that the only legitimate place for sacrifice is the temple in Jerusalem.
So the beam of what makes someone a true insider just keeps getting narrower and narrower.
And yet, even with those strict filters in place, there was still a massive amount of ideological wiggle room inside that remaining beam of light.
Right. Because if everyone agreed on the core foundation, one God, circumcision, the Torah, and the temple. The obvious question is, what on earth were they fighting about?
Right, which brings us to a massive cultural difference in how the ancient world viewed belief itself.
This is the mind-blowing part to me.
It is, because what's fascinating here is the ancient hierarchy of disagreements. In our modern Western framework, we place a massive emphasis on orthodoxy, which, you know, literally translates to right belief.
Right belief, yeah.
So if you and I have wildly different views on the nature of salvation, the Trinity, or the afterlife, we will likely split up and form two completely different denominations.
Oh, I mean, entire wars have been fought over highly abstract theological concepts.
Exactly. But for these ancient factions, the primary battleground wasn't orthodoxy. It was orthopraxis.
Right. Practice.
Yes. How you lived, how you acted, and precisely how you performed the physical rituals.
Okay, wait. I need to push back here for a second because it's just so foreign to us.
Sure.
You're telling me two guys could look at each other, completely disagree on the fundamental architecture of the universe, like whether humans literally rise from the grave at the end of time and be totally fine with each other.
Yeah, brothers.
But tracking the way water splashes off a hand makes them mortal enemies. Like, why did physical rituals hold so much more weight than cosmic truths?
Well, because practice was the ultimate visible metric of righteousness. You have to remember, we're talking about a world where ritual impurity was viewed as a literal physical contagion.
Okay.
It wasn't just a metaphor for sin. Impurity was seen as a miasma, like a physical force that could spread from an object to a person and then to the entire community.
Oh, wow.
And if it spreads, it severs their connection to God.
Which perfectly explains the bucket.
Yes. The infamous water bucket.
Yeah.
So if you look at a document called 4QMMT.
Catchy name.
Right. It's a brilliant grievance document discovered among the Dead Sea Scrolls. You see this play out perfectly. It's basically just a long list of highly technical complaints from a breakaway sect.
Just a scroll of them complaining.
Pretty much. And one of their biggest relationship-ending grievances was about the hand-washing technique at the Jerusalem temple.
Okay, so how exactly were they washing their hands that was so offensive?
So the priests in Jerusalem would line up, hold their hands out, and an attendant would pour pure water over them from a jug.
Seems pretty standard.
Standard practice, right. But the authors of the Dead Sea Scrolls, they were horrified by the physics of this.
The physics?
Yeah. They believed that the exact moment the pure water from the jug touched the impure hands of the priest, the impurity actually traveled up the continuous stream of water.
No way.
Up the stream, back into the jug, and contaminated the entire bucket.
That is wild. It's like, I don't know, spiritual electricity traveling up a current of water?
That is a perfect analogy. To their minds, the priests in Jerusalem weren't just washing incorrectly. They were actively weaponizing impurity.
Because they're ruining the bucket.
Exactly. By contaminating the main jug, they were subsequently pouring dirty water on everybody else, ruining the sanctity of the entire temple complex.
Oh, wow.
So that wasn't just a minor theological quibble. That was a catastrophic failure of practice that threatened the entire nation.
Wow. Because outward practice was the actual metric of survival, society fractured into these highly specific lifestyle groups.
Yes.
But, you know, the only reason we even have the specific names and categories for these groups today is thanks to a very clever ancient PR campaign.
Yeah, public relations.
Yeah.
We owe most of our structural knowledge about these factions to the first century historian Josephus.
Right.
But we always have to remember his underlying motive. He was a Jewish general who survived a brutal war with Rome, and ultimately he's writing his history while living in Rome, literally sponsored by the Roman emperor.
Okay, so he's writing for an audience that loves neat, logical categories?
Exactly. The Romans had their prominent, well-respected philosophical schools, right? The Stoics, the Epicureans, the Cynics.
Right.
So Josephus deliberately maps the Jewish sects onto this Roman framework. He calls them philosophies.
Oh, that's smart.
It is. He's essentially signaling to the Romans, look, don't look at my people as backwards provincial zealots. We are sophisticated, structured thinkers, just like you.
And he completely frames their internal debates around Roman interests, too, right?
Yeah.
Because the Romans loved debating the tension between free will and fate.
Oh, they loved it.
So Josephus writes extensively about how these Jewish sects felt about predestination, even though contemporary Jewish texts barely even cared about that specific philosophical framing.
It is brilliant PR. And to protect the broader Jewish population, he actually invents a category he calls the fourth philosophy.
Right, the fourth philosophy.
This was the precursor to the Zealots, the group that eventually sparked the violent revolt against Rome.
He needed a scapegoat.
Precisely. He isolates them as this fringe group of hotheads to spare the rest of the Jews from Roman retaliation.
Makes sense.
But the thing is, the Zealots weren't just angry rebels. They had a deep theological mechanism driving them.
What was it?
They believed that God was the singular, absolute ruler of Israel, period. Therefore, paying a census tax to the Roman emperor wasn't just an economic burden.
Oh, because it was acknowledging a different lord.
Exactly. Acknowledging Caesar as lord was an act of literal, unforgivable idolatry to them.
Man. So, by looking through Josephus's Roman-friendly lens, we can finally dive into the first and most famous of these main groups. And I find this group just fascinating because they essentially believed in stretching and bending the rules, basically to save the rules.
The Pharisees.
Yes.
This is a group with a massive modern PR problem, largely because of how they are depicted later in the New Testament as these rigid, unyielding antagonists.
Right. But when you look at the historical record, they were actually the progressive liberals of their day. Which, I know, sounds totally contradictory.
It does sound weird today, but it makes complete sense when you look at their mechanics. The name Pharisee likely comes from the Hebrew word paras, meaning to separate or make divisions.
Okay.
But their approach to the biblical text wasn't strict literalism at all. They were highly expansive. They championed oral traditions, storytelling, and extracting broad new meanings from ancient texts to apply them to a rapidly changing world.
Yeah, they didn't just read the words literally. They used a system called gematria, right? This, like, letter number math system.
Yes, gematria. In Hebrew, every letter has a numerical value. So the Pharisees believed that if two completely different words shared the same total numerical value, they were spiritually linked.
Wow.
And you could use one verse to reinterpret another verse entirely. It allowed them to reverse engineer incredibly complex modern laws out of ancient simple commandments.
My absolute favorite part of this expansive oral tradition, which, you know, eventually evolved into the rabbinic tradition, is the storytelling.
Oh, it's so good.
There is an incredible debate about the plagues of Egypt. So the Hebrew word for frog can function as a collective noun, meaning it can be singular or plural.
Right.
So one rabbi famously uses this linguistic loophole to argue that the plague of frogs in Egypt wasn't millions of frogs. It was just one giant frog.
Frogzilla?
Frogzilla. I love that so much. He argues this giant frog just sat on Egypt, and it would just spawn other frogs whenever someone hit it.
So vivid.
And eventually, another rabbi has to step in and basically tell him, okay, buddy, you've gone too far. Please stop.
Mm.
But that dynamic just shows how wildly creative and non-literal their interpretation could be.
And that creativity served a very specific protective function. Their overarching goal was to build a hedge around the law.
Okay, explain how that hedge actually worked in daily life.
Sure. So if the core biblical law says, do not work on the Sabbath.
Okay.
The Pharisees wanted to ensure you never even got close to accidentally breaking it. So first they had to define what work was. They decided writing was work. Therefore, a scribe cannot write on the Sabbath. But then they take it a step further to build the hedge. They ask, what if a scribe casually puts his quill behind his ear?
Oh, I see where this is going.
Right. He might forget what day it is, pull it out, and write. So the new rule becomes, you cannot carry a quill behind your ear on the Sabbath.
It's expansive, liberal interpretation leading to incredibly strict, granular living.
Exactly.
Like, if the text implies you can only walk 50 feet from your house on the Sabbath, the Pharisees will mandate you only walk 25 feet just to build a buffer zone.
Exactly. And theologically, they occupied a broad middle ground. They believed in a mix of human free will and divine providence. They believed in angels, intervening spirits, and, crucially, the bodily resurrection of the dead at the end of time.
But, you know, this kind of wild, expansive interpretation doesn't happen in a vacuum. Whenever you have a populist group inventing new rules out of thin air, relying on letter math and giant frogs...
Right, there's always a reaction.
It inevitably triggers a fierce institutional backlash. You get a reactionary movement that demands strict, literal adherence to the original text. And these are the Sadducees.
The Sadducees were the ultimate originalists. The name probably derives from Zadok, a famous historical high priest, which highlights their elite aristocratic origins.
They were the elites.
Very much so. The Sadducees looked at the Pharisees' oral traditions and hedges and completely rejected them. If a rule wasn't explicitly written in the books of Moses, the first five books of the Bible, the Sadducees just threw it out.
So because Moses never mentioned them, the Sadducees believed there were no angels swooping down, no intervening spirits, and no predestination. You have total free will to succeed or fail.
Yes. And most importantly, they fiercely rejected the concept of the resurrection of the dead.
Okay, here's where it gets really interesting to me. I'm trying to connect the dots on their social status.
Okay, let's hear it.
Because if you do not believe in an afterlife, if there is no grand reward or punishment waiting in heaven, then God's favor or God's wrath has to manifest right now, this physical life.
Right.
You're hitting on the absolute core tension of their entire worldview.
So if they were the wealthy upper class, their theology perfectly justified their status.
Yep.
If you are rich and powerful in this life, and this life is all there is, your massive estate and political power are the literal undeniable proof that God favors you.
It is an incredibly convenient theology for the elite establishment.
So convenient.
They're basically saying, look at my wealth. God obviously approves of my actions. And Josephus notes they weren't particularly popular with the general masses. He describes them as boorish and rude even among themselves.
Wow.
but they were highly educated, formidable debaters.
And their strict adherence to only the books of Moses changes how people had to argue with them.
Oh, completely. It dictates the entire intellectual landscape. There's a brilliant historical detail regarding a debate between Jesus and the Sadducees about the resurrection. Oh, yeah. Tell us about this.
So if you want to prove the resurrection of the dead using the Hebrew Bible, the absolute best text to use is the book of Daniel.
Right.
Daniel explicitly describes people sleeping in the dust of the earth, awakening to everlasting life. It is the perfect silver bullet. But Jesus doesn't use it.
Because the Sadducees didn't consider the book of Daniel authoritative. If it wasn't Moses, they didn't care.
Exactly. Yeah. So Jesus quotes the book of Exodus instead, Moses, at the burning bush.
Oh, smart.
He reminds them that God says, "I am the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob." And Jesus argues, well, God is not the God of the dead, but of the living. Therefore, those patriarchs must still exist in some form.
Oh, wow.
By using their own strictly accepted authority to dismantle their worldview, he demonstrates just a masterful understanding of his audience's filters.
That is fascinating. So you have the populist Pharisees making up new protective rules and the elite Sadducees hoarding wealth while clinging to the literal old rules.
Right.
If you're a deeply devout person looking at both of these groups, you might easily conclude the entire system is hopelessly corrupt. So you drop out of society entirely.
And that brings us to the Essenes and the ascetic sects. Josephus aligns the Essenes with Roman cynics because they completely rejected physical comforts and societal norms.
They just walked away.
Basically, yeah. They lived communally, shared all property, shunned slavery, and they were deeply involved in herbalism and astrology.
They believed in complete 100% predestination.
Yes. And that theological absolute dictated their lifestyle. I mean, think about it. If God has already scripted every single event in history, there is no point in striving for political power or wealth like the Sadducees.
Because it's already decided.
Exactly. You simply withdraw, purify yourself, and wait for the script to play out. Josephus claims they were shockingly accurate at predicting the future through omens.
Really?
Yeah. And they believed in a Greek-style spiritual afterlife, where the immortal soul just floats off to a realm beyond the ocean, free from the corrupt physical body.
But there is a vital distinction we need to make here, because history often lumps different groups together.
Yes, very true.
The philosopher Philo paints the Essenes as complete pacifists, claiming they wouldn't even manufacture a weapon. But they are frequently conflated with the sect that lived at Qumran, the group responsible for the Dead Sea Scrolls.
Ah, the ones staring at the water buckets in horror.
Right. And the Dead Sea sect were absolutely not pacifists, hippies growing herbs in the desert.
No, far from it. The Qumran community was a militant, apocalyptic offshoot. They maintained extreme celibacy and grueling purity rituals, not just for spiritual enlightenment, but because they believed they were preparing for a holy war.
They were basically preppers.
They were. They were preppers biding their time for a 40-year apocalyptic conflict. They fully expected that after the death of their founder, a figure they called the Teacher of Righteousness, they would march on Jerusalem alongside an army of angels.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, violently overthrow the corrupt priests, defeat the Romans, and establish God's kingdom on earth.
Okay, so let's just step back and look at the sheer chaos of this map.
It's a lot.
It is. You have the Pharisee hedge builders arguing about quills and frogs, the Sadducee elites hoarding temple wealth, the Essene dropouts reading the stars, the Dead Sea preppers waiting to trigger the apocalypse, and the zealot revolutionaries refusing to pay taxes.
Quite the mix.
It sounds like the entire region was just hopelessly fractured, tearing itself apart at the seams.
And if you rely purely on the surviving scrolls and historical texts, that is exactly the picture it paints. A society completely consumed by hyper-specific factional warfare.
But the real surprise, the absolute turning point of this deep dive, lies in the actual mathematics.
Yes. Josephus drops a bombshell statistic that completely reframes everything we've just discussed. Yeah. He actually gives us the head counts for these movements.
Okay, lay the numbers on us.
Pharisees, at their peak, about 6,000 men.
6,000, that's it.
That's it. The Sadducees, around 5,000, maybe even fewer. The Essenes, about 4,000.
Okay, so if we generously add in the zealots and the Qumran preppers, you're looking at roughly 15,000 to maybe 20,000 people heavily involved in these factions.
Right. Now, consider the estimated Jewish population in that broader region during the first century.
It was about 1 million people.
1 million, which means that all of these incredibly loud, historically dominant, fiercely ideological sects combined made up roughly 1.5% of the population.
That is just staggering.
It raises the most important question of all. What were the other 98.5% of the people doing?
They were just living their lives.
Exactly. The vast majority of the population were simply subsistence farmers trying to survive. They didn't have the luxury or the time to care about the metaphysical tension between free will and predestination.
No, they're busy farming.
Right. They weren't debating whether impurity traveled up the stream of a water bucket or calculating the gematria of a scripture verse. If you walked up to an average person on the street in Galilee and asked if they were a Pharisee or a Sadducee, they'd likely look at you like you were crazy and say, I'm just a Jew trying to feed my kids. Leave me alone.
Yeah. So what does this all mean for you listening right now? I think this ancient reality serves as a profound mirror for our modern world, especially, you know, in the era of information overload and social media algorithms.
Oh, 100%.
Because when you log online or turn on a cable news panel, it feels like society is hopelessly fractured into extreme, hyper-specific factions fighting existential wars. The parameters of our culture are constantly being defined by the most politically charged voices in the room.
And yet, just like in the first century, those incredibly loud voices, the ones writing the angry manifestos, declaring ideological purity, and drawing endless lines in the sand, they almost always represent a tiny fraction of the actual population.
The overwhelming majority of people are not engaged in the extremes.
No, they're not.
Most of us are just trying to get through the day without accidentally contaminating the bucket.
That's a great way to put it.
History is recorded by the loudest 1%, but it is actually lived by the quiet 99%.
It is a vital reminder to not let the loudest voices convince you that the whole world is on fire.
Truly. But before we wrap up, there is one final lingering concept from the historical record that I really want you to mull over. We started this deep dive talking about the beam of light, you know, the filters of identity that got narrower and narrower over centuries, excluding more and more people.
Right.
The ultimate victims of that narrowing beam were a group called the Samaritans.
Yeah, they were entirely excluded from the community.
Right. The Pharisees, Sadducees, and Essenes couldn't agree on anything, but they all agreed that the Samaritans were the ultimate other.
The one thing they could agree on.
Exactly. They weren't considered part of the overarching family because they failed the final filter. They worshipped on the wrong mountain. They believed Mount Gerizim was the holy site rather than the temple in Jerusalem.
Right, a catastrophic failure of orthopraxis.
And yet, they possessed the exact same Torah. They strictly followed the laws of Moses. They worshipped the exact same God.
It's crazy when you think about it.
It is. So I want you to consider this. What happens when the group you've definitively excluded as the ultimate enemy actually holds your exact same foundational texts and core values? Does our human obsession with finding the filters of separation, you know, the right mountain, the right ritual, the right label, does it eventually blind us to the fact that we are often just fighting our own twins?
We just get so intensely focused on the tiny, specific differences in practice that we completely ignore the massive foundation we share.
We really do. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive. Keep questioning the filters you use to view the world. Look past the loudest 1%. And remember, the next time someone splashes a little water on you, maybe just let it go.